This is the Preservation Technology Podcast, bringing innovation to preservation. The Preservation Technology Podcast is a production of the National Center for Preservation Technology and Training, a unit of the National Park Service. Hello, my name is Catherine Cooper. I am here with
Brett Bennington. I'm a professor of geology at Hofstra University on Long Island in New York.
And I'm Rodney Hill. I'm an associate professor of radio, television, film, also at Hofstra University in the Lawrence Herbert School of Communication.
You just published a book called After Apollo. Where did this project start?
It started because someone in the administration at Hofstra University thought it would be a good idea for Hofstra to do something to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing. And the reason for that is probably the location of Hofstra University in Nassau County on Long Island. Nassau County is where there were many milestones in the early history of flight, but it's also where the lunar module was built by the Grumman Corporation. And so there's this connection. Charles Lindbergh took off from a spot about a mile north of Hofstra University, basically from what is now the entrance to Macy's at the mall. But the call went out for faculty who would be interested in organizing a conference, and I've always had an interest in spaceflight. I was always a wannabe astronaut growing up. I'm an amateur astronomer. I mean, my day job is paleontologist, but I'm an amateur astronomer. So I immediately saw that this would be a great opportunity to do something interesting related to the history of spaceflight. And then they decided they also wanted a faculty member who represented not so much the sciences, but the humanities. And
yeah, and I will just also add that Hofstra University has a wonderful cultural center, and they put on conferences throughout the year on many different topics. They're actually known for their series of presidential conferences, looking back on the presidencies of recent administrations. I think the last one they did was... They just did one on Obama. So they do conferences on all sorts of things. And so it was kind of natural, given the Long Island connections to Apollo, that they would do something on the 50th anniversary. And as Brett said, they wanted to cover not only the science aspects, but also the humanities and the arts. And so the administration sort of came to me and asked if I would help and sort of oversee the humanities and arts side of things. I do film studies, and one of my big interests is Stanley Kubrick. And of course, Kubrick did 2001: A Space Odyssey. So we were actually able to work that in. Came out in 1968, so the film came out before Apollo, and I think it came out even before we had very good photographs of the Earth from space.
Right.
So all those visual effects in 2001 are just completely imagined. It's from the imagination of the filmmakers. That interest in Kubrick, and I've also always been interested in science fiction film, and so this was a great fit for me as well. So out of that conference, so Brett and I ended up sort of co-directing the conference. We had scholars from all over the country. And one of the high points of my life, and I'm probably speaking for you as well, one of the guests of the conference was Dr. Mae Jemison, one of the space shuttle astronauts. And
right.
Brett and I did a Q&A with her on stage, and I could have died then and there and been quite satisfied with my life. You know, it was like, it was a real honor to meet her. She was just
very
delightful.
Impressive person.
Gave a wonderful keynote talk for us. So that was really nice.
And there were a lot of little kids in the audience who knew exactly who she was and were really, there was a little girl, you know, it was probably like 6 or 7, sitting in the second row holding a Mae Jemison doll. And this kid was like vibrating in her seat. She was so excited. That was really cool.
Yeah, that whole experience really brought tears to my eyes, just being there with her and seeing the audience reaction to her.
Yeah.
We also did a screening at the Cradle of Aviation Museum of 2001, A Space Odyssey, and we brought over Jan Harlan, who was Stanley Kubrick's producer, and he introduced the film and did a Q&A afterwards. And that was a real honor for me to get to meet Jan Harlan in person.
And we had a film student.
Oh, yeah. One of our film students, she was a senior at the time, Connie Anderson Castilla. I think professionally now she goes by Connie Tace. She was one of my students in film, but she was also taking an honors course with Brett, and that's how she found out about our conference at Hofstra. And she approached you about, she wanted to do a documentary on the Grumman engineers.
About a half a mile from campus is the Cradle of Aviation Museum, which has the lunar module, the actual lunar module that would have flown on either Apollo 18 or Apollo 19. And they have volunteers who were former engineers, retired engineers, who worked on the lunar module, who kind of hang around the exhibit and will talk to you and tell you everything you want to know about it. And so I was able to connect Connie up with the people at the museum who worked with these volunteers, and she ended up interviewing a bunch of them and doing this wonderful oral history documentary. It was very moving, I thought.
When she first told me about the project, I was thinking, okay, this is going to be like a 10-minute student documentary. It'll be very nice. And she said, oh, no, this is going to be like 45 minutes long. And I thought, no, you can't do that. That's way too ambitious. But when I saw it, I was really blown away. She did a magnificent job. She traveled down to the National Archives and got a lot of
got a bunch of NASA images and footage sort of intersperse them, in with footage of gentlemen that she was interviewing.
It was really an extraordinary piece of work, and they showed it at the Cradle of Aviation, and I think it's been in a couple of other festivals. And Connie is now working with Ken Burns' company, so we were very proud of her. And so we took the best of those presentations and asked those authors to flesh things out and give us really full-blown essays that ended up in this book.
I know, it's a good example of how, if you volunteer to do things that are outside of your comfort zone, it very often leads to interesting opportunities. And, that's how you broaden yourself intellectually. So
these essays come from all sorts of different approaches, different fields of academia. So we have chemists represented in the book, but we also have political scientists and film studies people and cultural studies people. It's a really great collection. I'm pretty proud to be associated with it, to be honest.
There's so much variety, and it really shows how interdisciplinary and how broad-reaching the Apollo was, how important it was to all spectra of American society.
One of the things I think that comes out of this book is how it didn't necessarily have to happen. It wasn't inevitable. There's a chapter that discusses how these German rockets, so if you think about contingency, one of the things that happens after World War II is we invade Germany and we capture a bunch of German rocket scientists, including Wernher von Braun, and we bring them back to the U.S. and we put them to work. It just so happens that Wernher von Braun was an evangelist for space travel. The thing that he cared about more than anything was getting humanity off this planet, regardless of what you think of him as a human being, because of the fact that he used slave labor to build the rockets in Germany and he was bombing London and everything. If you listen to him, he did what he had to do to realize his vision of getting humans off the planet. And he ends up teaming up with Walt Disney to basically sell this idea that space travel is human destiny to the American public. And I don't think the space program would have been possible without that sort of propaganda groundwork that was done, that sort of planted the idea in the public, because it costs so much money to put astronauts on the moon.
Actually, the chapter on Disney and Wernher von Braun is written by somebody who was not at our conference, a former grad school buddy of mine named Chris Robinson. And I knew that he was interested in Disney television and that he had sort of been researching this. So I contacted him and said, hey, Chris, we're putting together this book. If you have something, we'd be happy to take a look at it. And this is like mid-1950s. We're talking 1955 or so, when Disney had just started his Disneyland TV series with ABC, which really was all about promoting the idea of Disneyland as he's building the park and sort of getting people excited about that. But then there were these different segments, including Tomorrowland, and this is where the Man in Space segments with von Braun sort of came into play. This Disney imagination of the future of humanity, right?
So you sort kind of funny good old German propaganda and American fantasy, sort of
capitalism
combining right. to lay the groundwork. And then, I mean, the first chapter in the book is this one by Matthew Hirsch, is this wonderful sort of take, sort of a review of the whole Apollo enterprise and how he calls it, we ran as if to meet the moon. He just points out how what a crazy idea. And it's kind of a miracle that it worked. I mean, there was nothing sort of predestined about it. And it could have gone wrong in 100 ways and never come to pass, but it did. And it changed everything.
And, one of the things he talks about is the fact that there always has been this notion that we could do that, that going to the moon is something that we could consider, right? So he sort of looks at the history of science fiction stories envisioning man going to the moon. This goes back at least into the 1800s with Jules Verne and other people. And then in the earliest motion pictures, you have these fantasy films of going to the moon. Okay. That's one of the things that Hirsch finds so amazing, is that we imagine that this is something we could think about doing.
Yeah, right? Méliès and all of those early silent films.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the beautiful things about science fiction. You have to imagine something before it can become a real thing.
And then it also almost becomes a template for, I wonder if we can do that, and then we invent things to make it happen.
Right, then how would we do it? What would this look like, and how would we do it?
There's another chapter which I like called Picturing Women in the Space Age, the Impact of the Lunar Landing on Films, Television, and Fashion, that looks at sort of how the space program impacted women. I mean, initially, women weren't really allowed to participate, but the sort of cultural fascination with space travel definitely did not exclude women. So you have women who are characters in TV and film playing important roles as space travelers long before NASA allowed women any significant participation as space travelers.
And the author of that chapter, Julie Wask, actually curated an exhibit at the Queen's Museum of all these images of women in terms of like fashion. I mean, you have fashion designers coming up with these space age looks, right, for women's fashion. And she also looks at a lot of film and television images. And so I think that's an exhibit that has been traveling around to other museums as well.
So you mentioned that there's this broad base of support, that this was basically sold to the public. But it wasn't for everybody in the public, and there's a chapter on that specifically, isn't there?
Yes.
Yeah, Patricia Rossi, who's an attorney on Long Island, I believe she's a civil rights attorney, among other things. Yeah, she talks about the backlash among civil rights leaders at the time, representatives, leaders from the African-American community, pointing out the irony of spending millions and millions of dollars on this, what they saw as a kind of superfluous gesture to go to the moon, while, obviously there's problems of poverty and injustice in the U.S. that need attention and need funding. Whatever somebody may think about that particular argument, Rossi points out that this controversy acted as a kind of
catalyst,
that's the word I'm looking for, a catalyst for a renewed energy in the civil rights movement to say, hey, come on, like if we can do this, we can also take care of these other problems.
Fix some things at home.
Right.
So. Yeah. She points out that even before Apollo 11 launched, Ted Kennedy came out basically in favor of canceling the Apollo program because it was costing too much money. Mm-hmm. John Kennedy's own brother just said that we can't afford to do this, that we're neglecting these other priorities, that people are starving in American cities, and we need to address that.
Yeah.
That argument, eventually became so compelling that Nixon did cancel the Apollo program. He politically couldn't justify the expense anymore.
It's too bad we didn't actually do anything substantial about the poverty problem, though, right? Like, okay, we canceled this one thing. That doesn't mean that we solved the other problems.
Rossi argues that this controversy did lead to some of the important civil rights legislation that came along in the late 60s and early 70s.
And then it's also tied to other important aspects of the United States policies with regards to immigration. because, I mean, we started with Wernher von Braun, whom we got from Germany, and then a whole bunch of other international figures are important to this as well.
There's a chapter by another Hofstra faculty member named Rosanna Parati, who talks about the critical role that immigrants have always played in the space program and the different sort of generations of immigrants. The original immigrants were the German rocket scientists and some Italian immigrants who came to the U.S. before and during the war to escape fascism. And then immigrants from other parts of the world became important to the space program after Apollo. She gives some nice examples of different individual people who were important.
Yeah, in various different capacities, including as engineers and some later astronauts, and so all throughout the space program.
My favorite is Farouk Albaz. He was a remote sensing expert from Egypt who ended up being a big part of training the astronauts to be extraterrestrial geologists, and in particular training the command module pilots to make observations of the lunar topography and lunar geology from orbit. Also part of their other scientific training.
Yeah. Kind of turning back to an earlier thing that we discussed, the rise and fall of public opinion around the space program. There was the Apollo program, and that got canceled due to funding.
Skylab comes in. Skylab was made possible by the fact that we had all this Apollo hardware lying around.
Okay.
One of von Braun's big ideas was to build a space station. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to do that by taking, I think it was a Saturn V midsection and converting it into a space station, which became Skylab. So that was the major, you know, manned spaceflight endeavor until the shuttle came along.
And then we had the shuttle and then another lull.
That brings us into sort of the modern, well, the International Space Station,
right.
Which now we're into the era of commercial spaceflight.
It occurs to me that the public attitude towards these things today is pretty lackadaisical compared to the zeitgeist of the late 60s when everybody was interested in space. I mean, certainly in American culture, I mean, it was such a part of everything. I mean, everybody was drinking Tang, all, you know, kids would be astronauts, all these TV series have astronaut things like Hydrogen Genie and all sorts of
And I think that that's James, the last chapter in the book is written by James Spiller, and he talks about that and that shift in sort of how the public perceived manned spaceflight and astronauts was deliberate in a way because the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo astronauts were promoted as explorers. This was the next frontier, and then they were the trailblazers that were risking life and limb to make it possible for humans to explore outer space. But Skylab and the shuttle, they were promoted differently. That was the idea behind the shuttle, was that space travel would become routine. And shuttle astronauts weren't explorers, they were the settlers, they were the pioneers, they were the blue-collar astronauts who were just, you know, going up into low Earth orbit to get the job done. Shuttle launches weren't supposed to be seen as these amazing, adventurous things. They were supposed to be seen as just business as usual. Didn't quite pan out that way because we lost two shuttles and wasn't very routine. It wasn't as safe as we wanted to think it was.
Spiller also talks about this transition from, you know, government-funded space travel to now the privatization of it. Mm-hmm. And so you have not only have you lost this idea of these explorers, but now it has become a thing. It's a phenomenon for rich tourists
to go up
for
and he raises seekers, specifically you know. Raises the question of, you know, are we going to be able to get the public behind human spaceflight if human spaceflight is seen as just a bunch of rich tourists going up into Earth orbit. I don't necessarily think that that's what's really happening. Yes, Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic, those enterprises are sort of predicated on being able to generate a lot of revenue by sending wealthy tourists up into low Earth orbit, but the people that go to Mars are not going to be wealthy tourists. They're going to be trailblazers in the mold of the Apollo astronauts, I think. And I mentioned this in the introduction. My feeling is that, you know, as long as, I mean, maybe part of the way we're going to fund space travel in the future is by getting rich people to pay lots of money to go, you know, on sightseeing tours, and then, you know, that money gets funneled into developing the technology and the hardware that we need to extend exploration. But there's, you know, government's always going to be involved because of the sums of money needed, particularly, you know, to develop really new technologies. And, you know, SpaceX is being supported and funded by federal government.
And we also have the Artemis program,
which is an interesting hybrid where NASA and its contractors are developing the rocket, but then NASA has given the responsibility for developing subcontracted the lunar lander to SpaceX and Blue Origin.
And, you know, given the fact that there has to be this ongoing government support of these initiatives, I think it's essential to somehow get the public back on board and get public enthusiasm renewed for this. You know, we're speaking to you here at this wonderful conference at Cape Canaveral that you've organized, and we've been hearing from various different perspectives, but one through line that I've noticed at this conference is, much like our book, I mean, the interdisciplinary aspects of this conference, you have people approaching these questions from an artistic standpoint. And I think that the mythologizing of it, making space this big, you know, this larger than life endeavor, if we can remind ourselves of the enormity of what has already been achieved, but what could be achieved in the future, and how that is important to the entirety of humanity, right? I mean, so I think that the arts and humanities could play a tremendous role in renewing that kind of enthusiasm. Some of the participants here at the conference have asked questions like, what should we be teaching our young people about, you know, people who want to be scientists and engineers, and how can they have an awareness of the historical importance of what they're doing so that they want to preserve the records of what they're doing? And I think that's where the humanities come in. I mean, you've got to somehow instill a love of history in the people who are running these projects. It's not just about the technical aspects. It's not just about the money. It's also about this amazing, I mean, the gesture of getting off the planet. It's an amazing, amazing thing. And I somehow, how did we ever lose that?
Is China going to be the next country that we're in a space race with? And will that motivate the public as a nation to care about space travel again? Of course, the other great motivator is money. And I think it remains to be seen whether there's money to be made beyond low Earth orbit. I mean, we know SpaceX has been very successful. Putting satellites in orbit is a very lucrative business. There's a lot of commercial applications to satellites, but is there money to be made on the moon? Is there money to be made in the asteroid belt on Mars? If there is, then I think we're going to colonize the solar system pretty quickly. If there isn't, then it remains to be seen, because if there's a financial imperative, then as long as there's money to be made, companies will be doing that. If there isn't, then the only reasons to expand beyond Earth become to get humanity off the planet as an insurance policy. So if we blow up the planet, we're still on the moon, we're on Mars. And then, of course, the other imperative is scientific. Mm-hmm. But one can argue you can do most of the science with robots, which we've been very successful with.
Sure, which is also not a very inspiring prospect, right? It's hard to get people excited about. But if things can be accomplished without astronauts on board these flights,
having people involved definitely makes people care. I mean, that's the human element is super compelling.
Thank you both so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Kat.
Thank you.
This was a presentation of the Preservation Technology Podcast, produced by the National Center for Preservation Technology and Training. To find more podcasts like this one, please visit our website,